in and meet the neighbors. And today I met like the real heavy Christian type who thinks her way is the only way.
Mm-hmm.
And she stopped me and asked me like all our beliefs first and then fired back.
Oh, really?
I wondered how to deal. I just told her, so many wars have been fought over this, and we have to respect our faith. Everyone has different faiths.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't walk away when they come up to you and want to talk. How do you best deal with people like that?
Well, I would say that over the years, I did not deal with them in the best way. Someone came up to me once like that, the day John Lennon was assassinated, and I was not in a good mood. I can't say what I told him. Pardon me?
It's the after class. Offering.
Yeah, not even. It's something I'm not proud of. But, yes, it depends on where we're located, how comfortable we are with our own beliefs. Like, no, always from the front, not from behind. You have to go in front. Yeah. No, but I'm just. But and then what happened? So, just putting it in the inverse, we're also known for our fanaticism. And I say we in quotes, but whatever. People who understand and know what I'm talking about, they get the idea. So we have some reputation, or have had a reputation being fanatical. So a long time ago, when that would be brought up to Srila Prabhupada, as it was from time to time, he said, in a very appealing, charming way, oh, you must forgive my devotees. But he said something very sweet and wonderful. He said that what they have is so valuable and they're so young. So forgive them if they might have, and wanting to protect that, they might have dealt with you unfairly or overreacted in some situation. But what they have is so valuable. And it's so delicate and so young that, they're trying to protect that thing. So from a generous point of view, we can extend that to others and say that it's sometimes actually symptomatic of a lack of conviction or comfort with one's own beliefs. This type of intense, what he's called, declaration of belief. Like I remember, of what little I remember of my, training from, I was trained by nuns. And so I have some familiarity, a little bit. I'm not very well versed in the Bible, the New Testament, and all those things. But I remember a few things. And one of the things I remember was about Pharisees going in the temple and making a dramatic show of their fallenness or their supplication to divinity. And the point being is that it was, being frowned upon as being not really symptomatic of true belief. Whereas we hear repeatedly from Srila Guru Maharaj that the wealth of one who's culturing devotion is negativity. And we see this throughout Krishna consciousness. And if you look at the expressions of substantial devotees, up to and including the most substantial devotee, who is Srimati Radharani herself, what expression of hers comes from the mouth of Mahaprabhu? Na prema gandosti drapi mehoro kundami so bhagya varam rakashitam. We're saying, I don't have a scent of the fragrance of Krishna prema, of love for Krishna. What to speak of a drop of that substance? So, when we hear associated with any belief system so much, self-congratulatory, self-certifying expressions, how much love someone has for the God of their choice, whatever name you want to insert. The Bengali saying comes to mind, Ati bhakti chorer lokan, that too much devotion is the sign of a thief. So, too much devotion is the sign of a thief. Something else is going on inside. And also, what is this necessity to aggressively assert belief upon others to somehow validate your own belief? The way you validate your own belief is by aggressively forcing that upon others. So, personally, over the years, I was, you know, when I was newly connected with Krishna consciousness, on Harinam or preaching, we'd sometimes run into these situations. And we've been through this whole tit for tat, tark v tark, argument, counter argument, your Bible quotes versus my Bible quotes. This, I don't think it's of any value. You know, that's my, you know, final conclusion. So, when this isn't going to work out, like, telephone, or it's not going to work.
She ended by us.
Dhanu Krishna, it's not going to work out. I know, I'm saying, so you can, if necessary for phone and things like that, it's better to go to the room.
No, he translated to, like,
I
spoke to
another door, just in
different
places. Oh,
okay.
So
I would
like
to not double
translation.
Okay.
It doesn't work, I can go to that.
No, I understand. I thought you were taking a phone call.
No, I was trying to translate your lecture. There's like 20 devotees.
Sure, that's fine. Then I will try and ignore it. No, please.
Or they could just see you lecture the next day and post to the Russian constituents. Sorry.
I'm saying it's fine. Continue. I thought it was something else.
The lady ended by saying she was
going to
pray for me.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Don't waste your time. Let her say what she thinks.
Right.
Be nice.
Right, we see Gurudev, the jujitsu strategy. The other side comes with full force and you just sort of dodge it and let it go. There's the famous atheist died in the last year, Christopher Hitchens. And many people were praying for him that he would, as he was dying from cancer, that he would have some kind of a deathbed conversion or something like that. And he said, it's not likely that I'm going to recant everything I've espoused over so many years, but I do, you know, if your prayers are well taken, you know, he tried with some grace to although he was a vehement espouser of atheistic beliefs, when he was, we're praying for you, he said, all right. And they wanted to have a national prayer day in his honor, that kind of thing. But, and, you know, we see, not in regard to Christianity, but but it can only work if it's like quieter. Anukrishna. If it's, yes, it has to be like a little quieter, the voice, because it's distracting. But, yeah. Anyway.
National prayer day.
Oh, right, for our friend the atheist. So I'm thinking when, just a parallel event, when Mahaprabhu went to Varanasi, and there was Prakashananda Saraswati, this great Mayavadi sannyasi with 60,000 disciples, 60,000 other sannyasis. And some of the devotees, Tapan Misra, and I forget the other, but they were telling Mahaprabhu, there was some pain in their hearts that living in this city, they say, where you never hear the name Krishna, but you're always hearing, you know, Maya and so many other things. And they're simple-hearted devotees. It was an unpleasant situation for them. And Mahaprabhu, kind of listening, somehow, and after some time, he goes to that assembly where Prakashananda Saraswati and all those sannyasis are. And we're told he enters and washes his feet, and where you clean the feet, which is considered a dirty area, not too far from that, he takes his seat. But as they all look over, we're told it's as if, you know, the Brahma Jyoti had entered like a thousand suns. This effulgence of Mahaprabhu, and they appreciated, oh, he has this extraordinary spiritual radiance. So Prakasananda Saraswati saying, well, why is he sitting over there by where we clean? Your Holiness, please, Sripad, come, come. And he brings him to his side, and he had heard news, rumors about Mahaprabhu, that there's this sannyasi, he's followed by 100,000 people, he's singing and dancing, tears are streaming down his eyes, he's sometimes falling onto the ground in ecstasy, rising again, dancing again, taking Krishna Nam madly, but not studying Vedanta, which at the time, and even Mahaprabhu took Mayavadi sannyas with the mantram Tattvamasi and Nausika, the shaved head, you know. So Prakasananda Saraswati thought, and he used the in Bengali word bhavuk, means, you could, I guess you could render it as a sentimentalist, someone who's overly sentimental, if you say it in a sarcastic way. So he's saying, why are you doing these things? A sannyasi should be grave and should study Vedanta and like that. And not all this singing, dancing, and getting emotional. You know. So what we sometimes condemn or caution about those, may again, back to my original, the Pharisees, oh, and I am so fallen, Lord, in front of everyone, making a big show. But he says, in that slogan, no prema gandasti dharapi mehoro krandam, krunda, crying. And he said, well, we see you're crying so much. He said, that is just to make a show to the people that I've got something. So make this show that people will think I have devotion. Right? This is why, this is the greatest enemy of the devotee, is pratishta, which means in this case, self-establishment. Right? If Pratishtha means name and fame, we hear in the Ramananda Sambhad, there is no greater name and fame than the reputation of having devotion to Krishna. We can say, well, that's not true in the regular world. We're not talking about the insane asylum, what's popular in the insane asylum, talking about, in reality, the greatest name and fame you can have is that you have devotion to Krishna, you have Krishna Prem. So Mahaprabhu says, this crying and showing symptoms, it's just to deceive people into thinking I'm a devotee. So the point being that those who have devotion, they conceal their position. They're not advertising that. They're not approaching others to establish themselves. Madhavendra Puri, in the dead of night, after Gopinath stole kheer for him, right? and revealed to the pujari that this Madhava Puri, there's six pots of kheer underneath my cloth. Give one to the Maharaj known as Puri. And so Madhavendra Puri is so happy to receive that, but then he realizes by morning the word will be out what's happened. We know how things work. So that pujari, he's going, you know what happened last night? What? Not going to believe it. Gopinath appeared to me in a dream.
Really?
Yes. And told this Maharaj who was here, the one who was getting the sandalwood pulp, the sandalwood and the camphor, the carpur for Gopal and Govardhan. Well, Gopinath said that he had personally stolen some of his kheer and directed me. I found under the dhoti, pot of kheer, took it. Oh. Then everyone, like wildfire, it will spread. He's so great. So what does he do? He flees. This is what an actual devotee does. He's running away from the reputation that he has love for Krishna. So Guru Maharaj will tell us, it's always measured in the inverse to the degree that we are in want. That shows necessity. To the degree that there is hunger shows the necessity for food. And Rupa Goswami gives examples. Daruka, the charioteer of Krishna, sometimes one of his duties is to fan, but sometimes he's overwhelmed by the beauty of Krishna or overwhelmed by realizing how fortunate I am. I'm the charioteer of Krishna. And the ecstatic symptoms well up within him to he's stunned and can't fan. And as ecstatic tears are streaming down his face, his body's full of horripilation and other ecstatic symptoms, he's cursing the ecstasy inside, saying, my job, my service is to fan, and because of this ecstasy, I can't fan. Rupa Goswami is giving that as an example of devotion. And in the case, and then followed by the example of Srimati Radharani, who, when ecstatic tears come from her eyes become flooded with ecstatic tears, the image of Krishna becomes blurred and she can't see Krishna anymore. So she's cursing those tears. What someone else might consider their inconceivable good fortune, she's cursing. So we're, as Srila Gurudev would say, my religion is finding fault with myself. His approach is to tolerate the arrogant assertions of other while decrying his own position. You may remember being with him in Geneva, right? In Switzerland, and going to the place of the Ramakrishna Mission. He was invited one evening with his entourage. He went there, and the head of that was this Indian gentleman who was boasting. By way, in the introduction, where he's supposed to be introducing Gurudev, he told the audience assembled there how he was the only Swami in the whole of Switzerland, and what his, what do they call it? Metric, where it means graduate, matriculation. Like how far he'd gone. He had a PhD, and he was telling everyone how qualified he was. And then in a very short way, said something about Srila Gurudev, Srila Govinda Maharaj, and then like, and now he'll say something. So Srila Govinda Maharaj said, "I'm so unqualified. I'm just a village boy. I have I didn't go very far in formal education. I'm so unqualified in so many different ways." Started telling just the opposite, how unqualified he is. And if we'll all just bear with him and overlook his qualifications. "But my Guru Maharaj, he is so qualified. And from him, by his grace, his mercy, he extended a little something to me." And then he like quoted a Sanskrit verse. And then he explained that, and then after a while, he quoted another one. After a while, he quoted around 20 or 30, like, heavy-duty Sanskrit verses, telling everyone how unqualified he was. And that man, he just started to, like, shrink in his presence. Right? As Balava Bhatta, boasting of his own qualifications, in the presence of and Mahaprabhu's devotees, no one's taking him seriously, which is interesting also. And then at one point, Kaviraj Goswami said, he began to feel like a crow in an assembly of swans, because they're all Paramahansa Vaishnavas. So all these beautiful swans with their grace, their elegance, and he felt like a crow, proud of his own na'a, learning. And insulting the great commentator of Bhagavatam, Sridhar Swami. Or as he said, my explanation excels his. And Mahaprabhu, in wordplay, Shami also means husband. He said, I think one who does not accept the Shami is a prostitute. So you do not accept Sridhar Swami? So he was dealt with in the beginning by neglect. And then Mahaprabhu made a few comments. Ultimately, he approached Gadadhar Pandit and put Gadadhar Pandit in a very awkward position. Because Gadadhar Pandit, being, you know, Srimati Radharani, minus her bhav, is more like Rukmini. So is very agreeable and not wanting to create any problem. But Balava Bhatta said, "Will you hear my explanations?" And Gadadhar Pandit said, "Mahaprabhu will be angry with me." But then he thought, but Mahaprabhu knows everything and he knows I don't want to hear this. Somehow it went ahead. But then there's the consideration, say dikare sanishnayanishta sagunai parikirtita adhikar, capacity, eligibility. Like we're told, one of the offenses to the holy name is to instruct the glories of the holy name to a faithless person. So someone might say, well, I didn't say anything about the holy name. It's not limited to that. It means to give Krishna conception to someone who has no faith in it or doesn't want to hear it. We're putting them in a position of committing offenses. So from many different points of view, we'll understand it's best for us to avoid the situation. But preachers take risk. Sometimes we don't know, as you say, they ask him, oh, could you explain something? And then, oh, some sincere person, we try to say something. Then we realize they have another hidden agenda. And then at that point, it's better for us to, you know, dandavat and withdraw. And they can say that they will pray for us.
Thank you very much.
But the minimum requirement is shraddha, or faith. And here we can take it. That means some willingness to give a hearing to Krishna conception. And this is how we see who has sukriti and who does not, who is truly pious and who is not. Because a truly pious person coming in connection with Krishna conception will recognize, will not offend it. They will appreciate it on some level, right? Even the current Pope Benedict, when asked about Krishna, he said, he can be seen as a Christ figure. So coming from him, that's a plus. So, what was I saying? That, oh, shraddha, faith, the willingness to hear. When years ago I would be invited to some Catholic schools that were run by Jesuits, by Jesuit priests. And they have something that they taught and employed called the willful suspension of disbelief. So they would tell the students before we come that for you to get inside this tradition or this other means of religious experience, we recommend to you the willful suspension of disbelief. Approach it from the position of a believer. How someone could believe like this, think like this, etc. Be open to that. So naturally, that worked very well for us. That's what we ask. And one place, and perhaps in the Bhagavad Gita commentary, Srila Prabhupada Swami Maharaj says, to make your approach, you have to at least theoretically accept the premise that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If you can theoretically accept that, then there's some hope. So that's why we find sometimes that some people who know absolutely nothing about Krishna consciousness, they get some exposure and they're happy about it. They can't articulate what it is, but they get some exposure and they smile and they think it's okay, or it somehow resonates in their hearts on a deeper level. And then there are those who, even with a little exposure, become very antagonistic, or it brings out some ugliness, then we can understand they're not happy champaks. And there's some duskriti that is, or what Gurudev said, quoting Guru Maharaj and Saraswati Thakur, some spoiling the lotus of their own good fortune. in Krishna Lila, sometimes asuras say offensive things about Krishna or to Krishna. But because it's part of Krishna Lila, Saraswati makes their words, turns their words into glorification. Like Shishupal calling Krishna Naradama. That means the lowest among men. But Saraswati turns it into Narottam, Narottama, the best amongst men. And there are, you know, different instances like that. So, as I've told my own little version of this, that Nietzsche, who's famous for this work of his where he says, God is dead. And there's more to that. He says, we have killed him. And it goes on. It's a, you know, I don't want to get into the details of this explanation. But this famous statement is attributed to him. It's in one of his works. But in another place he said, and he probably meant it sarcastically, said that if I were to believe in God, he would have to be an excellent dancer. So I offered that if Nietzsche had heard Srila Guru Maharaj's conception, that he could have found it charming. Because when we're presenting the end, the search for Sri Krishna to Srila Guru Maharaj, it's structured in a particular way, this book. It has structure, right? Ontological structure. And it culminates in one of the final slokas of the Prema Dhamma Stotram. What is it? Atma Lila Savasiddha Purna Lokya Sokya Lakshanam. What Guru Maharaj said is the ultimate conception of the ultimate reality, that reality ultimately must be dancing. Why? Because of when you're totally satisfied to the nth degree, the natural outcome is ecstatic dance. When your ecstasy means besides yourself, outside yourself. So it manifests in the form of dance. So he's saying the highest conception of the ultimate reality must be dancing, and that alludes to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who, relishing his own sweetness, the outcome is ecstatic dance. So, and there's so many beautiful slokas about that. Nindantam pulakot karin bikasam nipa prasunachchavim prodrikritva bujadvayam hari hari ituchai vidantam muhu. And his waving his arm, he's dancing ecstatically, hari hari, chanting the name of Krishna. Nityantam, nityantam, dutamastru nirjara chai. And while he's singing and dancing, tears are streaming from his eyes, making the ground before him muddy. That quantity of tears, ecstatic tears. Dutamastru nirjara chai, sinchantam urvitalam, gayantam nija parasadai parivitam. With his devotees, Sri Gaura Chandram Nama. So, we can identify, even in what seems to be opposed to Krishna consciousness, we can adjust it in different ways for our own edification. But really, we don't want to give people the opportunity to commit offenses. That we know also. That if we enter a certain discussion or a certain situation, that someone is likely to become offensive. So we try and avoid that and not allow for that kind of a circumstance to happen. But I would say in your case, like Gadadhar Pandit said, Mahaprabhu knows that I don't want to be in this situation, how this came about. So he'll forgive me.
That's one of their trained approach. in a real neutral way, and then
right.
they come on.
Yes, so. That's. The way it is. And there's also the statement in Bhagavad Gita by Krishna, let not the wise disrupt the minds of the ignorant. So if someone is at a particular stage of development, and if we're comfortable with our own belief, not in this, I don't mean that in the sense of complacent, but I realized this in time also. When I was younger, I thought, I need to convert others. But as I got older, I realized, I've heard the best of their arguments. They have failed to convert me. So, we prefer to be, you know, non-aggressive, non-assertive, while still maintaining that Nam Sankirtan, preaching, and Guru Maharaj's words is the highest form of disinfectant. It disinfects the environment. But at the heart of the matter, there has to be some willingness to hear what Prabhupada used to call the a potent speaker and a fertile listener. If that's there, then there can be a spiritual transaction. Like in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Sishyasteham Sarimam Tvam Prapanam, Arjun saying, now I'm surrendering myself to you, please instruct me. Otherwise, it won't be a spiritual transaction. Any other question? His question before was saying that in Audio Veda people ask, what was it? If God has made us the way we are, how does this question go? Basically, it comes down to, I'll restate the question. That if he knows everything and he knows we're going to sin by having free will, why did he make us like this? And it seems to indirectly point to some fault on his part. But Srila Guru Maharaj will point out, free will is what distinguishes us from, you know, inert matter. Free will, consciousness, free will, choice. And Guru Maharaj's famous example about Gandhi, when the Indian independence movement, at one point the British said, the reason we're not giving you independence is because you're not qualified for it. You'll abuse it. You'll misuse it. That's why we're not giving it to you. In a patronizing way, they told us. And Guru Maharaj said Gandhi's answer was, freedom means the right to do wrong. It can't just be one way. Or when Guru Maharaj switched it to taste, you can taste bitter, you can taste sweet. The tongue gives you the capacity to taste rasa, to taste sweetness. But it also gives you the capacity to taste bitter and any other sort of thing in between. So freedom means the right to do wrong. So if you withdraw this ability to choose, to exercise free will, and say, no, they can only be like this, then you don't have conscious living beings anymore, because consciousness implies freedom and choice. So, upadrishtanu matan cha bharta bhokta maheshwara paramatmeti chapayukto dehesmen purusha apura to paramatma. The upadrishta is the observer, the overseer, who's in a neutral position, not interfering with the minute independence of a jiva soul, not interfering with their choice, allowing them to choose as they see. And what have we been seduced by? The satanic mania that it's better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven, as given in Milton's Paradise Lost. This prospect. Do you want to reign in hell or be the king of hell or a servant in heaven?
Actually, the question was, why God punish us when we choose wrong way?
Oh, all right. So, and then in terms of punishment, so then we choose to live in a world where for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? The world of exploitation. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he presents it this way in the Jiva Dharma. That if you take gold and you want to purify it, you have to place it in fire. When you put fire on gold, all the impurities are removed, and what remains is pure gold. That's how you determine the carat, the quality of gold. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, the so-called miseries that are inflicted upon the jivas, they're like this fire that removes the impurities and brings them to their golden condition. You understand? So, from an overview, it's not objectionable. If the outcome is utter purity, all the dirty things are removed, then it's a good thing. So, I've mentioned at different times that I used to live by a fire station, or where the chief used to live, the fire chief in San Francisco. And outside there was a plaque, a brass plaque that they kept very shiny and had this few lines of poetry on it. And remember, they're firemen. And the poetry says, by fire shall hearts be proven, lest virtue's gold grow dim. So it's saying this virtuous potential we have, what will bring it out is the fire of circumstance. Or in this case, you think the punishment, miseries, the miserable conditions of material existence can be what is the word? Not dovetailed, but I can't think of the proper word right now. But they can be a catalyst for purification. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, Matra sparsha stukonteya sitoshna sukadukada agama payano nityas tam titikshasva bharata. Titikshasva means tolerate. Saying, Arjuna, this world, hot and cold, heat and distress, happiness, sorrow, just tolerate it. Right? As you get bad things without trying for them, good things also come to you. Don't put your energy in that. The Bhagavatam. Tasyeva hetu prayate to kovido na labhyate brahmatam uparyata. Try for that thing that you couldn't find wandering the length and breadth of the universe. That's the culture of Krishna consciousness. But Guru Mahārāja says the message of the Gita is tolerate, don't quarrel with the environment, go within yourself, make the adjustment there. And additionally, he gives an example. He's saying, when you're talking about punishment, saying, as long as the child is in denial, like the mother knows they've done something wrong, and they say, no, I didn't do that. Like, I used to tell my mother when I did something really, different, it's hard to describe, but like, say she'd come back and find, like, for some reason I wanted to burn pieces of rubber to see what happens. And then she'd come back and the whole kitchen, which was yellow, had little black dots all over it. And she said, what happened? And I said, you know, some man came in here and he started burning rubber. I have no idea why he did that. And then he left. So my mother, my punishment was to not talk, to have to like stand in the corner and look at the wall and not speak. So that's because of being in denial, of lying. But Guru Maharaj said, if you acknowledge your fault, say, actually, I am the culprit, in his words, that you alone are the only culprit. If you acknowledge that, he said, then the punishment is not necessary. The punishment is to bring you to the point of acknowledging what your responsibility. Right? Karja karna kartitve hetur prakritir uchite purusha sukha dukkhanam. I forget the rest. But it's a sloka, the Gita, where the responsibility, Krishna is saying, is yours, right? Is the jiva's. He's not responsible for this. We are responsible for that. So really, we are responsible for the suffering. And say, well, not a blade of grass moves without the will of God. That's true. In the background, so the Bhagavatam tells us, tatenu kampam susamikshamano bunjana evatma kritam kripam ripakam. Susamiksha. Samiksha means to examine, to analyze. But susamiksha means to really scrutinize. So on a deep level reading of what's going on environmentally, circumstantially, our karmic circumstances, this Bhagavatam sloka, according to Guru Maharaj, is saying, realize the friendly hand of Krishna is in the background of all of these things. He's not like an Old Testament God punishing people, the wrongdoers. He's watching it. He's going to club you, right? If you don't do what I say, you know, lest I smite thee from the face of the earth. He's just so angry. Not like that. You see, the friendly hand of Krishna is in the background. So on a deep level, what do we hear? That the exalted soul, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj, like Sukadev Goswami, the general populace, they thought he was a madman. Children would call him names, follow him. They said a group of children were mocking him on his way to the assembly where Parikshit Maharaj, with all the sages, where he's offered the presidential seat to address the finest minds of the universe have assembled there. They're offering him that seat. On his way to take that seat, children are mocking him. Right? So, Yani Sha Sarabhutanam Tashmi Jagrati Samyami. They can't recognize who he is. They don't have the skills, the capacity to recognize a spiritually evolved person. They're seeing from an external point of view. In a similar way, sometimes children were being naughty and throwing things at Gaurkishore Das Babaji Maharaj. They thought he's some crazy old Baba, some pug old Bengali sadhu. So, but what was his response? And here he's saying, because he's a Mahabhagavatam, has deep range vision, seeing Krishna in everywhere, in everything, and not just in some generic sense or a paramatmic sense, but he's seeing Swayam Bhagavan Krishna. So what did he say? Krishna, you're the cause of these children throwing. It's you. They're throwing those things. I know, it's not them. I have no quarrel with them. I know you're behind this. Why are you doing that? Throwing things at me. But I know how to deal with you also. So I'm going to approach Ma Yashoda. And she knows what to do with you. She'll be coming after you with a stick and give you a whipping for this type of misbehavior. That's the angle of vision of Gaurkishore Das Babaji Maharaj. And now we'll say, well, he's Gaurkishore Das Babaji Maharaj. He can see things like that. What about us? Then we're told, people say, what is the use of philosophy? You use philosophy to interpret your life circumstances. That's what it's useful for. Anybody can think in an ordinary way, in a conventional way, but it takes someone who's sincerely engaged in Krishna culture to apply this type of understanding to their own circumstances and their own lives, and to think, all right, so the great devotees who actually, their eyes are open, they can see reality, they're saying, Krishna's in the background. I can't see it, but I'm a blind person. I don't possess deep level seeing. But those who do, they've said that this is how you read the circumstances. So on the basis of my faith in them, I will apply their analysis to my circumstances. And I'll walk in the plane of faith, my belief in them. That's the idea. But I like Guru Maharaj's quote about no pride does the Lord tolerate in the heart of a devotee. And he used Peter as an example. The famous, on this rock I build my church, Peter, the leader of the 12 apostles. That when Christ, we know the famous, who did that picture? Leonardo? The Last Supper, and they're all like, is it I? It's been, you know, one of you will betray me. And where they're all wondering, could it be me? Who will it be? And Peter at one point boasts, I will never betray you. Maybe some of these others. I'm not like that. I will never betray you. You don't have to worry about me. And I said, before the, cock crows, you will betray me before the cock crows thrice. Something like that. He's dismissed. And so that man, and who betrayed, who, he said, you'll deny you've ever even known me. We know it was Judas who did the act of so-called betrayal. He said, but you'll deny that you've ever known me. That's also a type of betrayal. But, so Guru Maharaj concluded saying, so no pride does the Lord tolerate in the heart of the devotee, even the pride that I'm your devotee. He said, so Peter, who was the leader, was exposed. But, still, there's salvation is possible. He later becomes the head of the church. Why? Because mercy is above justice, as told in Merchant of Venice, and it droppeth like the gentle rain from heaven. There you go.